I would like to suggest a concept, a very simple concept, to help us understand the contradictions and paradoxes of freedom in American society. That concept I take from the writings of my good friend Karl Marx, and therefore it is almost guaranteed to be misunderstood. Because misunderstanding Karl Marx is practically one of the major industries in the United States. It makes enormous contributions to the gross national product. For example, several years ago when I employed this distinction, the discussion out in, I think it was Wyoming, used it to deal with American history, Daniel Boorstin, who is now a librarian of the Library of Congress, all but had an apoplectic fit. And thought that I was saying that the entire American enterprise has been nothing but a crass exercise in trying to make as much money as possible. I don't mean that at all, as I hope you'll see. The concept I want to use for Marx is this concept of the bourgeois revolution, or the concept of bourgeois democracy. It sounds foreign to American ears. It sounds as if it's just a meaningless and empty term. I think it's profound. And what Marx meant by bourgeois democracy is a system in which you have political democracy, but economic and social inequality. And his fundamental argument was that in such a society, the outcomes of the society, the lives of the people in the society, would be in conflict with the theoretical political equality. That people would be politically equal once every 4 years when they vote for President of the United States, once every 2 years when they vote for representatives to the Congress of the United States, but all of the rest of the time, and actually even on that election day, they are economically and socially unequal. And that this meant that our democracy was a democracy subverted and vitiated, a democracy containing a conflict built within it. What I want to suggest, in contradistinction to some interpretations of the American past, you cannot understand that past unless you understand that it was, that conflict was a central feature to it and a good feature to it. Indeed, we begin the American enterprise by our struggling against mercantilism. That was the immediate origin of the American Revolution. And you know what mercantilism did to us? Back in the 18th century, exactly what we do to the third world today. Because what the British wanted us to be, they wanted us to be the suppliers of raw materials and agricultural products, and they had the kind of discriminatory governmental policy that we now exercise toward the third world. That is to say, American raw materials and agricultural products could go into the British market with practically no duties, but if we had the temerity in the United States, the colonial states of America, actually to engage in manufacture, we discovered that we were systematically discriminated against, and in a number of instances, Britain actually struck down our infant industries. Therefore, in part, the American Revolution was a struggle for economic independence. By the way, it was also a struggle for political liberty. I'm not saying that it was simply the struggle for economic independence. But I'm saying that at the very beginning, we found ourselves, in a sense, as a colonial revolutionary movement of the kind that we now so often try to suppress. And from that time on, the problem, this conflict, therefore what was set up in American society, was not simply democracy, but democracy with these capitalist limitations. And of course, you have one of the great documents in American history which says this straight out. I really don't have to labor the point. Some people call it the beginning of American Marxism. It is a class theory of politics that was written actually before Karl Marx was born. I am referring to Madison and the Federalist Papers, in which Madison says, what we are doing is recognizing that the most dangerous thing in society is factionalism based on property differences. And where Madison tells us, the structure of the American government, the federal structure of the American government, is in effect created so as to frustrate propertyless majorities. Not minorities, majorities. Federalist Papers are very clear But what is feared is the rule of the majority. And therefore, we have our tripartite system, we have our unrepresentative Senate, we have all kinds of devices, so that I would guess that in the United States, to make a major social policy innovation, you require support of about two-thirds of the people, not 50% plus one. So we begin in conflict, we begin in fear, we begin with property rights right up front in the Federalist Papers, with a constitution designed to protect those copyrights, and I don't property rights. And I don't go so far as Charles Beard in his economic interpretation of the Constitution, who I think simplified this process considerably. But there was a tremendous element of the protection of property from the very beginning in American society. There was, of course, in the Constitution another feature. Now, that feature was the provision whereby slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person for the purpose of giving representation to whites. We recognized in our Constitution from the very beginning the most obscene and vicious form of private property, the right to own human beings, was part of the American inheritance. So, from the start, there is this conflict. In the case of slavery, it leads to a civil war, but a civil war which also has very interesting economic and social dimensions. One of the explanations which has been given by a number of recent neo-Marxist scholars, I'm thinking particularly of André Gunder Frank, but also of Michael Barrett Brown in England, of the difference between Latin America and the United States in terms of their economic development, is that in Latin America, the South won the Civil War. That part of the Civil War was a struggle, of course, between export-oriented, raw materials, agricultural-oriented slave owners who wanted free trade, and northerners who wanted manufacture and industry. And in the United States, thank God, for many, many reasons, the North won. And in Latin America, the South won. And therefore, the permanent dependency, the structural inferiority of politically independent Latin American countries is accounted in part, at least, you account for it, by the economic and social content which it had. Now, one other point relating to this is that in this American society, with this conflict structured into its constitution, structured into its history, a conflict which we like to ignore in this society because we like to think of ourselves as classless, which is nonsense. Throughout our history, and we have not celebrated this very much in the bicentennial year, throughout our history there was an underground movement of conflict struggling against those limitations. For example, how many of you are aware that the first working class political parties to exist anywhere in the world existed in the United States, specifically in 1828 and 1829 in Philadelphia and New York? And that there was a sense in which the young Marx and Engels looked to America as an advanced country in terms of its potential for socialism. How many are you aware that in 1825, one of the most prominent European socialists of his day, Robert Owen, addressed a joint session of the Congress of the United States, and the President of the United States and the President-elect of the United States and the Supreme Court attended in the Congress of the United States a lecture on the socialist future of America. In 1825, America was the only country on the face of the earth where the national parliament would gather around to hear a socialist speak. And yet this aspect of our history, that we had the workers' parties in the 1820s, that we had socialists speaking in Congress in the 1820s, this gets lost. Or that out of that working class agitation came one of the most significant movements for freedom in American society, the movement for free land. That was a working class movement. It was a movement often inspired by socialists. Culminated, of course, in the Homestead Act of 1862, signed into law by Abraham Lincoln. There was an enormous popular working men's, working women's agitation for free land. Again, to quote my favorite German philosopher, Karl Marx, he was very shrewd on this development. Because he said the paradox is, and I take American history to be a paradoxical history. In America, the first impulse toward socialism will take the form of a demand for private property. That is to say, there are all kinds of simple-minded radicals who said, how can you have a radical movement that wants private property? And Marx understood something profound about this drive toward free land, that it was the radicalism of the workers that took the form of a utopia in which everybody would own their own chunk of land. That was part of the American dream of freedom. In fact, we now know, retrospectively, what some few people understood at the time, that free land went mainly to the railroads. That the main beneficiaries, even as far back as the 1860s and 1870s, of government action, the main beneficiaries were powerful moneyed interests. I would make the general rule of thumb that in a society, social inequality, government acts, the long range, would to benefit the rich more than anybody else. And that this is visible even in the movement of radicals for free lands, culminating in the Homestead Act of 1862. America in the 19th century, I think this is one of the reasons American socialism has failed so miserably. America in the 19th century was in some ways the most utopian country on the face of the earth. That was one of the problems. There were tremendous numbers of agrarian utopias in this country. Funny money utopias. If only we will do this or that to the gold or the silver standard. If only we will print this kind of currency, we can solve everything. The country was filled with it. One of the problems of socialism in the American trade union movement was that the trade unionists who wanted to fight for wages, hours, and working conditions got so sick and tired about being lectured on the future of humanity that eventually they turned anti-utopian and anti-socialist. But what I want to stress is this conflict in this country throughout the 19th century gave rise to utopias, to desires to go beyond the limitations of bourgeois democracy, to bring in real equality in the society. There was a tremendous shift, and now we're heading toward the present. There was a tremendous shift in the 1880s and 90s in American capitalism and capitalism. There came into existence corporate capitalism, imperialist capitalism. In England, and that's about it. Had the semblance of an economy of private producers responding to a free market and maximizing the demands of individuals. Gone. That moment, the rise of the corporation, the rise of the working class and socialist movement, and in Europe, the welfare state began at the end of the 19th century and in the first decade of the 20th century. In the United States, we didn't get a welfare state till the 1930s. Why? Why does America today have the most cheap and backward welfare state on the face of the earth? And we do. We are the only advanced industrial country in the world without national health. It is my radical left-wing desire that on the 100th anniversary of national health introduced by Bismarck into the Kaiser's Germany, that we in America can catch up with that Bolshevik Bismarck radical Junker type. But why? Why did this country, which had the conflict, which had the Workers' Party, which had the struggle for free land, which had the most violent labor history anywhere in the world. Not only did we have class struggles in America, but the class struggles more often turned to dynamite and guns. The troops were used against the workers more openly here than anywhere else. But why in this country, with that heritage, did we then get no socialist movement after a tremendously promising start under the leadership of Gene Debs from starting in 1901 and with a marvelous and charismatic figure like Norman Thomas in the 1930s, why did that socialist movement fail? And more importantly for all of us, Why is it that in the United States we got the welfare state so late and so cheap? And I think there are many answers to that. This was a country which, once we committed genocide against the Indians, had a continent to conquer. This was a country which did not, as in the case of European capitalism, build on the remnants of feudalism, did not inherit from feudalism a sense of class, of deference, etc. That this was a country composed of exceedingly adventurous people who fled Europe, who fled feudalism, who fled class distinction. All these things played a role. But I think there were two major reasons why America did not develop a socialist movement and was so late in even developing an effective liberal movement. One reason is the enormous heterogeneity of the American people, and particularly of the American workers. That with these waves of immigration, you had tremendous conflicts between workers, between the native-born and the immigrants. The native-born thought that the immigrants were destroying their position in life. And among the immigrants, where you had the differences between black and white, between Catholic, Protestant, and Jew, between Italian, Polish, Irish, etc., all of this. So that, for example, in the United States, in the period right after the turn of the century, when you had a strike in out in Pittsburgh among workers in steel mills, you had to have the speeches translated into four or five different languages. Because most of the workers couldn't understand English. And they all came from different ethnic backgrounds. And this inhibited their getting together. This separated them. They were pushed together as a social class, but they were pulled back by their ethnicity. I think that was one reason why the left in this country never developed politically as it should have. And the second reason is one that I take from a strange book by a man by the name of Leon Sampson. The book has the sort of bizarre 30-ish title of A Political Philosophy for the United Front. It was published in the 1930s. It is one of the shrewdest books on the subject I know. And it's Sampson who said, America had the socialist version of capitalism. Because you have to remember, in America, we are all taught as kids that we're equal. You're not taught that in France or in Britain. You certainly weren't a generation ago, maybe a little more now after the struggles of the labor movement have succeeded somewhat. Those were societies in which a worker was considered to be dumb, in which workers were not told that they could rise up to be presidents of corporations or the head of the society. You didn't tell that to everybody in England. You don't tell them to this day. America is the peculiarly egalitarian bourgeois democracy. And for example, let me just take one case in point. In Europe, the socialist movement, paradoxically, got its main impetus in the struggle for bourgeois democratic rights. Every socialist movement in Europe began as a movement not to change capitalism, but to get the right to vote inside of capitalism. Every socialist movement in Europe began as a civil rights movement, as a movement of human dignity. In America, because with the not small exception of women and blacks, we had universal suffrage almost from the beginning, in a crazy way, because America was so free to begin with, those conflicts did not gel into a movement to make it more free. And let me end this first point here in a summary fashion by saying that in America, you have built into our very structure, our concept of freedom, a profound limitation. That is the limitation that we are a democracy of political equality, but economic and social inequality. But this gave rise to enormous conflicts, but that these conflicts never succeeded in creating a mass radical, or even until Franklin Roosevelt, an effective liberal movement, for a number of historical reasons, among which I would single out two. The fact that in America you had this egalitarian spirit which made people less radical, paradoxically. The fact that the workers came from so many different backgrounds. Okay, that's something on the past. What about the present? In terms of the present, I would suggest to you that America, for some time now, has been engaged in the wrong debate. Has been engaged in an absolutely fraudulent debate, as a matter of fact. All unwittingly and with goodwill, nothing intentional about this, at least on the part of most people. For example, There are still some trusting souls who talk about a free enterprise option for the United States. Now, to begin with, free enterprise is not a descriptive term. It's a rationalization. You take two terms that everybody is in favor of, freedom and enterprise. And you put them together and you say free enterprise, and it sort of suggests an idyllic America with competitors, little shops, everybody's free, everybody can save up, and Horatio Alger, and enterprise is the key thing, when the fact is that America, as I'll indicate in just a minute, has nothing to do with the one in which we live, which is dominated by enormous and powerful private bureaucracies working usually in tandem with the governmental bureaucracy. It's not a free enterprise economy, it's not even a private enterprise economy. We live in what you might call a state monopoly, or if you want to get more precise, state oligopoly capitalism, not in free enterprise. But we continue to talk as if that were a choice. We continue to build on myths. For example, there are all kinds of Americans today who think that the government spent enormously on social priorities in the 1960s. I should tell you, to begin with, that in the 1960s, we often talked as if we were doing a lot. But most of the time, we didn't do it. That the increases in social spending in the 1960s were two-thirds accounted for by Medicare and Social Security increases, two programs which most Americans are for, two programs which worked. That the idea that in the 1960s, we had this enormous amount of money that was being lavished on radical social experimentation is an idea deeply held probably by a majority of Americans today, and it's an idea that's false. And therefore, we get locked into absolutely silly debates for serious reasons. We ask ourselves sort of Barry Goldwater-type questions. Shall we go forward to a more bureaucratized society, or backward to what? I mean, if you heard Barry Goldwater at the Republican convention, strange. Here he was telling the American people that after 8 years of Republican presidents, we were on the verge of socialism. I was enormously heartened by the announcement, but I don't take it seriously because there is no choice of going back. What that conservative Goldwaterite Gerald Fordite myth really means is government should do the work of corporations. The fact that this is expressed in terms of an Adam Smithian idol fools a lot of people, but it shouldn't fool anybody who examines it very carefully. Let me counterpose to the Horatio Alger, Gerald Ford, Barry Goldwater version of the American reality, I think a more accurate one. Let me begin with the main institution in American society, the decisive center of our power system, the corporation. The corporation has two major rationalizations in the American ideology. One rationalization is that we live under a system of consumer sovereignty. That is to say, the corporation humbly responds to the wishes of the consumer, and therefore, rather than having some intellectual like Harrington up there telling you what kind of toothbrush you got to use and what kind of breakfast cereal you're going to eat, we let you vote in the marketplace for things of your choice. That's the ideology. There are a couple of rather structural problems with that ideology. Problem number one is that in a society of extreme maldistribution of wealth, some of the people in this consumer democracy of ours have many more votes than others. And what we have, if we have a consumer democracy, it is a democracy in which the rich stuff the ballot box. Secondly, that version of American corporate behavior assumes that corporations are totally unable to control the market, that they are only responsible to the market. The problem being that when you have monopoly or oligopoly, the corporations have enormous power over the market. Thirdly, the theory of consumer sovereignty overlooks one of the most important educational institutions in the United States. It's called the advertising industry. And it's an industry which rationalizes enormous waste. My favorite, I think, is breakfast cereals. Can you imagine what television would be like without breakfast cereals? It's one of the main things that keeps it alive. And yet we have had testimony before Congress that most breakfast cereals have a nutritional value pretty close to zero. And you have all this stuff, you're getting these vitamins, and the kids love it, and all this kind of stuff. Nutritional value close to zero. The big argument in defense of breakfast cereals was that the milk and sugar you put on them was good for you. So I'm saying, number one, that argument for the corporation I don't find particularly compelling. Number two, we have a theory of stockholder democracy. The corporations are responsive internally to a number of checks and balances, to the consumer in the market, but also to the stockholder. But the problem with that is, as you know, stock ownership in the United States is enormously concentrated among rich people. In 1970, for example, General Motors had 1,400,000 stockholders, which sounds great. There's only one little kicker. 90% of them had less than 200 shares, which meant that 90% could play no role whatsoever in really deciding what the largest industrial corporation in the United States was going to do, a corporation which has a yearly output which exceeds that of most powers in the United Nations. It is not checked by its stockholders. It is not checked by the consumers. In fact, what the corporation has increasingly become is an institution which raises money from retained profits and doesn't have to go into the money market, which controls the consumer market. It becomes an autonomous law unto itself rather than anything like the corporation of free enterprise in it. Now, at the same time that the corporation becomes autonomous in this fashion, you have got the government moving to integrate with the corporation and to follow corporate priorities. This begins in the New Deal. And let me make one thing clear to begin with, that in criticizing the welfare state, I am not saying that the welfare state is nothing, that it doesn't count. The welfare state was created by the struggle of working people and of black people and of women and of precisely this conflict trend in American life. And I treasure the gains of the welfare state, but the problem is that the welfare state created by the people for themselves has increasingly become a tool of corporations against the people. Secondly, in terms of introducing the idea, the fact that the rich in the 1930s fought tooth and nail against the welfare state should warn us against having simplistic theories about how ruling classes run this country. Because in the 1930s, when Roosevelt was trying to save the capitalists from destruction, the capitalists kept throwing back the life preserver. Roosevelt said, here, save yourself. They'd say, you traitor to your class, and they would say, you're a communist, you're some kind of a rat. He was saving them. And the best educated and wealthiest people in the United States in the 1930s proved themselves enormously stupid. Parenthetically, I would argue that throughout human history, sadly, people without education have shown a much higher degree of insight and value than people with education. Quite seriously. And I'm an educator, and I'm not happy at reporting that, at knocking my own product, so to speak. But the fact of the matter is, in England, during our Civil War, the mill hands who were adversely affected by the war were for the North, and the Oxford graduates were for the South. The mill hands were right, and the Oxford graduates were wrong. Okay, so this welfare state development is not one that fits into a simplistic theory of economic determinism, because the people whom it most benefited fought. But now it has most benefited it. And let me just suggest, first, the mechanism whereby it does this, and secondly, a couple of cases in point. And the mechanism is this. The capitalist state is not itself a capitalist. Therefore, the only way for the government in a society dominated in an economy dominated by private corporations, the way the government promotes the common good is to promote the good of the corporation. What I am saying is that the theory of trickle down, that you give money to the rich and it will trickle down to the rest of the society, is not a theory of our society, it is the theory of our society. And that theory is structured into the society by virtue of the fact that one of the most important economic functions, investment for new jobs, is in private hands. If you're president of the United States and you want to get more employment for the people, you've got to be nice to corporations because they basically control the employment decision. And therefore, the way we get employment in the United States with Keynesian tactics, in general, has been to stimulate the upper class, the corporate rich, and to assume that it would trickle down, which has, among other things, continued the maldistribution of wealth and made us subject to private decisions in areas of enormous social importance. Let me give you one example of this. We have a system right now where a corporation can get an investment tax credit for leaving New York City. The federal government will give a corporation a subsidy for taking its jobs out of New York City and exporting them to, not simply Texas or Georgia, we'll do that, of course. You can get a subsidy for exporting those jobs to Mexico, Taiwan, South Korea, wherever. Nobody thinks about the social consequences of that. The federal government subsidizes something that creates higher unemployment, higher costs on food stamps, higher costs for welfare, not to mention such small things as increasing alcoholism, family breakdown, suicide, and the other pathologies which are associated with this kind of deterioration. What I'm arguing is that the federal government does that not because the federal government is perverse or stupid, but because it is following a consistent set of priorities which are usually disguised from the American public, and those priorities are basically corporate priorities. And it does so, again, not because it's malevolent, not because it's against the workers and the people, but because in a society dominated by private corporations where they are in charge of future investment, you have to be nice to corporations first and think about people second, third, fourth, and fifth. What I'm saying then to tie this up is that the reality of American society today has very little to do with our mythology. And our mythology, which we inherit in considerable measure from John Locke, as George Cabot Lodge of the Harvard Business School has pointed out in a recent, very excellent book, our mythology says that the defense of individual freedom is private property. But now private property, which is not evenly distributed, to put it mildly, in its corporate form, has allied itself with government, and the structural problem we have is how can we, the people, in order to protect freedom, in the late 20th and 21st century, get some kind of hold on that enormous, concentrated, in the case of the corporation, unresponsive power. Which leads me to the third point I want to make, which is some few ideas on the future. And here let me give you a broad idea on the future and then I'll narrow it down a bit. The question about the future is not whether America and the world are going to become collectivist. That question is already decided. America is going to be collectivist in the future because it is more collectivist every day. By collectivist, I simply mean that we are making economic decisions politically and not by the market. The question is not whether we will make economic decisions politically. We are already doing it. The question is who will make them politically, how will they make them politically, and for what purpose. The choice is not collectivism or free enterprise. The choice, I think, is whether we will have corporate collectivism, the use of the collective political power and economic decision-making on behalf of the values of a corporate elite, which I think has been the dominant tendency of the last 20 or so years, or whether it is possible to have what I would call democratic and humane and libertarian collectivism, which is what I mean by democratic socialism, and which requires structural transformation of the power in the United States, above all the corporate power, which is not simply a private economic power, but because of its alliance and integration with the state, is increasingly a political power. How do we go about that? Number one, an issue that has been outrageously ignored for at least, and I think much more than a generation, we have to redistribute the wealth of the United States. The figures that you hear are normally figures about the distribution of income. The reason you hear them is they're not as bad as the figures about the distribution of wealth. That is to say, the maldistribution of income is not quite as bad as the maldistribution of wealth. Wealth, I suggest to you, is the dirty little secret of American society. This is a country in which people will talk about their sex lives on television talk shows or to Playboy magazine, but if you ask them about their money lives, it's like it would have been going to a Victorian grande dame and asking her about her bedroom habits. That's the dirty secret. Therefore, our data are very poor, because it is a dirty secret. But the most reliable data we have, they were used by the Joint Economic Committee this year, show that the bottom 25% of the American people own 0.0% of the American society. I happen to believe this is an underestimation. I'm dead serious. Because I suspect that you would find that the bottom 25% of the people have negative wealth. As I say, they're in hock. It's not they don't own anything. They owe. They have negative assets. The bottom 25% have nothing in terms of wealth. The top one-half of 1% owns 26% of the society. That, the 76% the people own about 25% of the society. So you got an idea of the enormous inequality of this society with this tiny pinnacle composed of people who make $200,000 a year, who receive more than half of their income from unearned income, that is to say, not from working, from not working, just for being Nelson Rockefeller. $5 million just comes and sticks to your finger every year. By, you know, the accident of his DNA and his birth, he's worth, and he pays taxes, of course, on only $1 million of it, because $4 million of it providentially comes in forms which are not taxable. If you look at Rockefeller's tax returns as presented to the committee that held hearings on his nomination as vice president, you'll find that his federal tax rate was about 18%. On his real income, it's sort of, by using all kinds of devices, it looks like it's about 35%. It's really about 18%, which is to say that Nelson Rockefeller pays less of a percentage of his income than most working people in the United States, than almost anybody in the United States. 18 is very low. Okay. We have to get at wealth. And here I think there is a rather relatively simple way to do things. The Internal Revenue Code is one of the main agencies for the perpetuation of inequality in America, the law. It contains enormous handouts for the rich. There are two capital gains handouts for the rich, which in 1977 are going to be worth $13 billion to the rich in 1 year, whereas the federal contribution to the major welfare program, aid for the families of dependent children in that same year, is targeted at $8 billion. Two deductions worth 165% of the main federal welfare program. That's, I'm afraid, the way our value system has been. That should be changed. Secondly, that's not enough. Because that really, we could redistribute the wealth and things would be still pretty terrible in the United States. We have to, in terms of the Northeast, where I'm from, if urban civilization is going to be viable, we have to have national economic planning. We have to allocate resources to the Northeast. We in the Northeast, we in New York City, don't want welfare. We want jobs. We want work. We want a viable economy. We have been victimized because the federal government, in following corporate priorities, has created the New York City crisis. The federal government paid middle-class and working-class people to leave New York by subsidizing the housing of the rich rather than the poor through a dozen programs, by building federal highways for people to get out to suburbia, and in building the highways by helping to destroy the railroads and mass transit. The federal government paid billions to get people to leave New York City, and the federal government paid billions to send us people into New York who could not cope with it. That is to say, federal agricultural programs going primarily to rich farmers and agribusinesses, financed the displacement of millions of undereducated, poverty-stricken, and racially discriminated against Americans in the South and in Puerto Rico. And so here are federal programs which took our resources away and gave us new problems. And now what we need to get out of this, since the spontaneous tendencies of the American economy and society are anti-New York, we have to have conscious political planning to put resources into New York. Let me give you just one beginning idea, absolutely moderate idea, which could be utilized to do this. We now give an investment tax credit to a corporation to take jobs out of New York. I would like to propose a simple change in the law. You only get an investment tax credit if you do something in a way that promotes social purposes. Example, you only get the investment tax credit if you bring jobs into New York, not for going out. As a matter of fact, I would like to penalize corporations for leaving New York. Not penalize them, simply charge them a fair share of the cost of the social havoc they are going to create by leaving. But you've got to do these things nationally. Because I don't want New York to get jobs at the expense of California jobs. That's not a solution. You don't solve the New York City crisis by creating a Los Angeles crisis. And the point is that these things will not happen by the invisible hand of Adam Smith, of course. They have been happening because the government has been following corporate priorities and public programs to disastrous social effects. And what we have to do is to get the government to follow social priorities, which is, again, another way of saying to democratize this whole process. A third way. I believe, and here George Cabot Lodge, who is a Harvard Business School professor, albeit a fairly radical one in my opinion, agrees with me, that the chartering laws should be changed. The charter is, in theory, an agreement between the society and a corporation where the society allows the corporation to function in return for what the corporation will do for it. For the last 100 years, that's been a joke. The charter has been an absolutely ridiculous, laughable requirement. Anybody can get one. Now we should have a serious charter. We should have a federal chartering of all major corporations. And one condition of the charter should be public and employee representatives on the boards of directors. General Motors claims that it has the managerial prerogative to secrecy. I argue that General Motors' actions taken in the boardroom are more important for American society than the actions of all the city councils of this country, of all the state legislatures, and of the Congress of the United States most of the time. The only institution in the United States which I know which really makes decisions which are more important than General Motors are the Congress sometimes and the President of the United States. And therefore, General Motors is in fact social, is in fact public, and I think it should be made a public corporation in the sense that we have public and employee representatives on the board of directors, and the first thing I would ask them to do would be to violate corporate secrecy and to tell us on what basis pricing policies are being determined, on what basis plant location policies are being determined, and so forth and so on. Okay, so I think that there are things that can be done. I'm a socialist. Obviously, I'm concerned with a fundamental democratization of power, of new forms of social property, of rather than giving the energy industry, which created our energy crisis, $100 billion in cheap money. We asked the cattle thieves to build us a new barn. Rather than doing that, I would like to see the publicly owned TVA-type gas and oil corporation that Senator Adlai Stevenson has proposed. I could go on and on, but let me take one final point, which I think is very important, very elusive. I don't know how to say it. I'm going to say it very quickly, and I apologize for its incompleteness. But in addition to all these economic problems, in addition to all these social problems, I feel that American society today is in a great spiritual crisis. I don't think we know what we believe in. And one of the problems is that God has died. Now, by that, I don't mean the whether or not God exists or not. Make up your own mind on that. All I'm saying is that as an actor in the society, a God has become less and less relevant. As the German Protestant theologian who was murdered by the Nazis, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, put it, we no longer need God as a working hypothesis of the society. Now, whether he exists or not, that's another question. He's not a working hypothesis in society anymore. And indeed, I take it that the recrudescence of fundamentalism, the phenomena like the Moonies and other such outbreaks of spirituality are not a sign of a new faith, but of a desperate faith, in my opinion. It's a sign of the absence of faith in this society. So we've lost God, which as a political actor, as a public actor, is a cement for the society. We used to believe in making money. As good old Cal Cooley said, the business of America is business. We don't really believe in that anymore. In the 1950s, we got a considerable amount of unity and purpose in the society out of being anti-communist. But the good old Cold War is just not that handy and convenient anymore for uniting people, thank God. Even though in the television debate on foreign policy, it was a contest in machismo, as far as I could tell. But we don't know what we believe in. And at the same time that we are very uncertain about what we have believed in, the breakdown of all the old authorities of church, of family, of patriotism due to Vietnam, of belief in the corporation, of belief in free enterprise, belief in business, all these things have broken down. At the same time, there has been a sexual revolution in American society, a revolution in personal conduct. And I think we are therefore in a, we have a spiritual crisis. I identify this crisis not because I have an answer to it. Anybody who tells you he's got an answer to the spiritual crisis is kidding. What I think is true, that if America began once more to gain some kind of control of its environment, to master, we now have the feeling that we are being overwhelmed by all these circumstances which are out of control. If we began to control our circumstances, that would not guarantee a spiritual rebirth. I think it might make it possible. It would be more propitious to it. And let me close on that point, with a point that was made by one of the great profound pessimists of the modern age, sociologist Max Weber. And Max Weber said that the modern age is characterized by a tremendous increase in functional rationality, but not by a corresponding increase in substantive rationality. That is to say, in every subdivision of our life, we are more technological, more computerized, more precise, more quantified, more mathematical, more brilliant than ever before. We are functionally rational. We have understood every part in its relationship to every other part, and we'll understand much more. The only problem is our functional rationality seems to bring an irrationality of the whole. That the more brilliantly calibrated the parts become, the more problematic the whole becomes. And we look back on societies which were not so brilliant and seem to be happier to us. But we can't go back to them. But I do think, not that I've got an answer in my hip pocket, that it is at least possible that if we began to seize control of the determinants of our economic and social existence and to resolve this contradiction of political democracy and social and economic inequality, that would be a beginning of getting a hold of that world that threatens to overwhelm us, and it might be a setting in which people and a society could once again find some common meaning. Thank you.